cold like we were, the two of us together. We were going to pick up a present for Mama, he told me, his big hand on my head like he did, a scarf or maybe gloves. The streets were all full of people, so many people, all different ages and looks to them. I like to think about it even now, to send my mind back to that day. No one remembers Christmas anymore, but it was a bit like first night is now. I don't recall if we got the scarf and gloves or not. Probably we did. That's all gone now, all of it, and stars. Time to time I think that's what I miss seeing most of all, back in the time before. From the window of my bedroom I could look over the roofs of the buildings and the houses and see them, these points of light in the sky, hanging there like God his own self had strung the sky for Christmas. It was my mama who told me the names for some and how you could watch them a while and start to see pictures up there, simple things like spoons and people and animals. I used to think you could look at the stars and that was God right there, like looking straight into his face. You needed the dark to see him plain. Maybe he forgot us and maybe he didn't. Maybe it was us who forgot when we couldn't see the stars no more. And to tell the truth, they're the one thing I'd like to see again before I die. There were other trains, I do believe. We'd heard about trains leaving from all over, that other cities had sent them before the jumps got in. Maybe it was just people talking like they do when they're scared, grasping at any bit of hope that floats on past. I don't know how many made it all the way to where they were going. Some were sent to California, some to places with names I don't just now recall. There was only one we ever heard from back in the early days, before the walkers and the one law, when radio was still allowed. Some place in New Mexico, I do believe it was. But something happened to their lights, and we didn't hear from them again after that. From what Peter and Theo and the others tell me, I do believe we are the only one left now. But the train in Philadelphia and what all happened that winter was what I meant to write on. Folks was in the worst way. The army was everywhere, not just soldiers but tanks and other things of the kind. My daddy said they were there to protect us from the jumps, but to me, they were just big men with guns, most of them white, and my daddy had always told me to look on the bright side, Ida, but not to trust the white man. That's how he said it. Like they was all one man. Though, of course, that seems funny now. Folks all blended together like they are. Probably. Whoever is reading this doesn't even know what I'm talking about. We knew a fella from up the way got himself shot just for trying to catch a dog. I suppose he thought eating a dog was better than nothing. But the army shot him and strung him up on a light post on Alney Avenue with a sign pinned to his chest that said, Looter. Don't know what he was trying to loot except maybe a dog that was half starved and going to die anyway. Then one night we heard the loudest boom and then another and another and planes screaming over our heads, and my daddy told me they'd blown the bridges. And all the next day we saw more planes and smelled fire and smoke. And we knew the jumps was close. Whole parts of the city were on fire. I went to bed and woke up later to the sounds of a set to. Our place was just four rooms and voices had a way of carrying. You couldn't sneeze in one room without somebody in another saying bless you. I heard my mama crying and crying. And my father saying to her, you can't. We have to. You be strong, Anita. Things of the kind. And then the door to my room swung open, and I saw my daddy standing there. He was holding a candle, and I'd never in my life seen him with such a look upon his face, like he'd seen a ghost and the ghost was his own self. He dressed me quick for the cold and said, be good now, Ida, and go say goodbye to your mother, And when I did, she held me a long, long time, crying so hard it makes me hurt to think of it even now, all these years gone by. I saw the little suitcase by the door and said, "Are we going somewhere, Mama? We leaving?" But she didn't answer me. She just went on crying and crying and holding me like she did, until my daddy made her let go. Then we left, my daddy and me, just the two of us. It wasn't till we were outside that I realized it was still the middle of the night. It was cold and blowing. Flakes were falling and I thought it was snow, but when I licked one off my hand, I realized it was ashes. You could smell the smoke, and it was stinging my eyes and throat. We had to walk a long way most of the night. The only things moving on the streets were the army trucks, some of them with horns on top and voices coming out of them, telling people not to steal, stay calm about the evacuation. There were some folks about, but not many, though we saw more and more the farther we went, until the streets were thick with people, no one saying a word, all walking the same direction as us, carrying their things. I don't think I'd even figured it out in my mind that it was just the littles who were going. It was still dark when we got to the station. I've already said a thing or two about that. My father told me we got there early so as to avoid the lines. He had always hated lines, but it was like half the city had the same idea. We waited a long time, but things were turning ugly. You could feel it, like a storm was coming, the air whizzing and cracking with it. Folks was too afraid. The fires were going out. The jumps were coming. That's what people were saying. We could hear great booms in the distance, like thunder, and planes flying overhead fast and low. And each time you saw one, your ears would pop, and you'd hear a boom a second after, and the ground would shake below your feet. Some folks had littles with them, but not all. My father held my hand tight. There was an opening in the fence where the soldiers were letting people in, and that's what we had to get through. It was so tight with the people pressed together, I could hardly take a breath. Some of the soldiers had dogs. "Whatever happens, you hold on to me, Ida," my daddy said. "Just hold on." We got close enough that we could see the train down below us. We were on a bridge, the rails running under it. I tried to follow its length with my eyes, but I couldn't. That's how long it was. It seemed to stretch forever, 100 cars long. It didn't look like any train I ever saw. The cars didn't have no windows, and long poles stuck out from the sides with nets hanging from them like the wings of a bird. On the roof there were soldiers with big guns and metal cages, like something you'd put a canary in. At least I supposed they were soldiers, on account of they were wearing shiny silver suits, to protect them from the fires. I don't remember what happened to my father. Certain things you can't remember because your mind won't take them up once they're done and gone. I remember a woman who had a cat in a box, and a soldier saying, "Lady, what do you think you're doing with that cat?" And then something happened quick, and believe it or not, that soldier shot her right there. And then there was more shooting, and folks tearing about and pushing and screaming, and my daddy and me got separated in all of it. When I reached for my daddy, his hand wasn't there no more. The crowd was moving like a river, dragging me along with it. It was a horrible thing. People was yelling that the train wasn't full, but it was leaving anyway. If you can imagine, I'd lost my suitcase, and that's what I was thinking of. I've lost my suitcase, and my daddy's going to be hopping mad at me for that. He was always saying, "Look after your things, Ida. Don't be careless. We work hard to have the things we do, so don't go treating them like nothing." So I had just about figured I was in the worst trouble of my life all on account of the suitcase when something knocked me to the ground, and when I got up I saw all the dead folks around me. And one was a boy I thought I knew from school. Vincent Gum. That's what we always called him. Vincent Gum. both names together, and wouldn't you know, that boy was always getting in trouble on account of he liked to chew gum and always had a piece in his mouth at school. But now he had a hole in him right in the center of his chest, and he was lying on his back on the ground in a puddle of blood. There was more blood coming out of the hole in his chest in little bubbles, like soap in a bath. I remember thinking, that's Vincent Gum, lying dead right there. A bullet went through his body and killed him. He's never going to move or talk or chew his gum or do nothing at all, and he'll be right there in that spot forever, with that forgetful look on his face. I was still on the bridge over the train, and folks were starting to leap down to it. Everyone was screaming. A lot of the soldiers were shooting at them like somebody had told them to just shoot anything, no matter what it was. I looked over the edge and saw the bodies piled up there like logs on a fire and blood everywhere. So much blood you'd think the world had sprung a leak. Somebody picked me up then. I thought it was my daddy. He'd come to find me after all, but it wasn't. It was just a man. A big, fat white man with a beard. He snatched me up by the waist and ran to the other side of the bridge, where there was a kind of pathway down through some weeds. We were at the top of a wall above the tracks, and the man held me by the hands and lowered me down, and I thought, he's going to drop me, and I'm going to die like Vincent Gum did. I was looking right at that man, and I'll never forget his eyes. They were the eyes of a person who knew he was as good as dead. When you have that look, you're not young or old or black or white, or even a man or a woman. You're gone from all those things. He was yelling, "Somebody take her. Somebody take this girl here." And then somebody grabbed my legs from below and lifted me down, and the next thing I knew, I was on the train and it was moving. And somewhere in there, I came to think I'd never be seeing any of them again, not my mama or daddy, or anybody I had known in my life to that day. What I remember after that is more like a feeling than any actual thing. I remember children crying and being hungry, and the dark and heat and smell of bodies all crammed in. We could hear gunfire outside and feel the heat from the fires passing through the walls of the train like the whole world was aflame. They got to be so hot you couldn't even touch them without burning the skin of your hand. Some of the children weren't no more than 4 years old, practically babies. We had two watchers in the car with us, a man and a woman. Folks think the watchers were army, but they weren't. They were from the FEMA. I remember that because it was written in big yellow letters on the backs of their jackets. My daddy had people down in New Orleans. He'd grown up there before the service, and he always said that FEMA stood for Fix Everything My Ass. I don't remember what became of the woman, but that man was first family, a chow. He married another watcher, and after she died, he had two other wives. One of those wives was Maisie Chow, old Chow's grandmother. The thing was, the train didn't stop. Not for anything. Time to time we'd hear a great big boom, and the car would shake like a leaf in the wind, but still we kept right on. One day the woman left the car and went back to help with some of the other children, and came back all crying. I heard her tell the man that the other cars behind us were gone. They'd built the train so that if the jumps got into a car, they could leave it behind, and those were the booms we'd heard, one car after another falling away. I didn't want to think about those cars and the children inside them, and to this day, I don't. So I'm not going to write anything more about that here. What you'll want to know about is when we got here, and I do remember something of that, because that was how I found Terrence, my cousin. I didn't know he was on the train with me. He was in one of the other cars. and it was a lucky thing he hadn't been in one of the cars at the back, because by the time we arrived, there weren't more than three and two mostly empty. We were in California, the watchers told us. California wasn't a state like it used to be, they said. It was a whole different country. Buses would be meeting us to take us up the mountains someplace safe. The train slowed to a stop, and everyone was afraid but excited, too, to be getting off the train after all the days and days. And then the door opened, and the light was so bright, we all had to hold our hands over our faces. Some of the children were crying because they thought it was the jumps. The jumps were coming to get us. And someone else said, "Don't be stupid. It ain't the jumps." And when I opened my eyes, I was relieved to see a soldier standing there. We were someplace in the desert. They took us off, and there were lots more soldiers around and a line of buses parked in the sand and helicopters thwacking overhead, stirring up the dust all around and making every kind of a racket. They gave us water to drink, cold water. All my days, I've never been so glad just to taste cold water. The light was so bright to my eyes it still hurt me even to look around, but that's when I saw Terence. He was standing there in the dust like the rest of us, holding a suitcase and a dirty pillow. I'd never hugged a boy so hard or so long in my life, and we were both laughing and crying and saying, "Look at you." We weren't first cousins, but more like second, as I recall. His father was my daddy's nephew, Carlton Jackson. Carlton was a welder at the shipyard, and Terence later told me his daddy was one of the men who built the train. A day before the evacuation, Uncle Carlton had taken Terence to the station and put him in the engine car closest to driver and told him to stay there. "You stay put, Terence. Do what driver tells you." So that was how Terence had come to be with me now. He was just 3 years older than me, but it seemed like more at the time, so I said to him, "You'll look after me, won't you, Terence? Say you'll do that." And he nodded and said yes, he would. And that was just what he did until the day he died. He was the first Jackson who was household, and a Jackson's been household ever since. They loaded us onto the buses. Everything felt different to me with Terence there. He lent me his pillow to use, and I fell asleep with my head leaned against him. So I couldn't say how long we were in the buses, though I don't think it was more than a day. Then before I knew it, Terence was saying, "Wake up, Ida, we're here. Wake up now." And right away I could smell how different the air was where we were. More soldiers took us off, and for the first time I saw the walls and the lights above us, standing high on their poles, though it was still the daytime, so they weren't on. The air was fresh and bright, and so cold all of us were stamping our feet and shivering. There was army everywhere, and FEMA trucks of all sizes full of every kind of thing, food and guns and toilet paper and clothes, and some with animals in them, sheep and goats and horses and chickens in cages, even some dogs. The watchers put us all in lines like they'd done before and took our names and gave us clean clothes and took us to the sanctuary. The room they put us in was the one most everyone knows, where all the littles sleep to this very day. I took a cot next to Terence and asked him the question that was on my mind, which was, "What is this place, Terence? Your daddy must have told you if he built the train." And Terence was very still for a moment and said, "This is where we live now. The lights and walls will keep us safe. Safe from the jumps, safe from everything until the war is over. It's like the story of Noah, and this here is the ark." I asked him, "What ark and what are you talking about, and will I ever see my mama and daddy again?" And he said, "I don't know, Ida. But I'll look after you like I said." Sitting on the bed on the other side was a girl no older than me, who was just crying and crying, and Terence went to her and said quietly, "What's your name? And I'll look after you too if you want," which made her stop. She was a beauty, that one. You could see it plain as day, even as dirty and worn down as all of us were. The sweetest little face and hair so light and wispy, it was like a baby's the way they do. She nodded to what he said and answered, "Yes, would you please do that? And if it's not much trouble, can you look after my brother too?" And wouldn't you know that girl, Lucy Fisher, became my very best friend and was the one that Terence married later on. Her brother was Rex, a little bit of a thing, who was just as pretty as Lucy, except in the manner of a boy, and I'm guessing you probably know that Fishers and Jacksons been mixed up together one way or the other ever since. Nobody said it was my job to remember all these things, but it seems to me that without me to put them down, they'd all be gone by now. Not just how we came to be here, but that world, the old world of the time before. Buying gloves and a scarf at Christmas, and walking with my daddy up the block for water ice, and sitting in a window on a summer night to watch the stars come on. They're all dead now, of course, the first ones. Most been dead so long, or else taken up, that no one even remembers their names no more. When I think back on those days, it's not sadness I feel. A little sadness for missing folks, like Terence, who was taken up at 27, and Lucy, who died in childbirth not long after, and Maisie Chow, who did live a good while but passed in a manner I don't just now recall. Appendicitis, I think it was, or else the cancer. The hardest to think on are the ones who let it go, the way so many did over the years. The ones who took it into their own hands. From sadness or worry, or just not wanting to carry the weight of this life no more. They the ones I dream on. Like they left the world unfinished, and don't even know they've gone. But I suppose it's part of being old to feel that way, half in one world and half in the other, all of it mixed together in the mind. No one's left who even knows my name. Folks call me Auntie, on account of I never could have no children of my own, and I guess that suits me fine. Sometimes it's like I've got so many people inside me, I'm never alone at all. And when I go, I'll be taking them with me. The Watchers told us the army would be coming back, bringing more children and soldiers, but they never did. The buses and trucks pulled away, and as darkness settled down, they sealed the gates, and then the lights came on, bright as day, so bright they blotted out the stars. It was a sight to see. Terence and I had gone outside to look, the two of us shivering in the cold, and I knew then that what he said was so. This was where we would live from now on. We were there, together, on first night, when the lights came on and the stars went out. And in all the years since then, the years and years and years, I never have seen those stars again, not once.
Part 4. All Eyes. First Colony, San Jacinto Mountains, California Republic. 92 AV. O sleep, O gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse, how have I frighted thee, that thou no more wilt weigh my eyelids down, and steep my senses in forgetfulness. Shakespeare, Henry IV, Part 2. Slide number 1. Reconstruction of First Colony Site. 33 degrees 74 minutes north, 116 degrees 71 minutes west. Presented at the Third Global Conference on the North American Quarantine Period, Center for the Study of Human Cultures and Conflicts, University of New South Wales, Indo-Australian Republic, April 16th through 21st, 1003 AV. Document of One Law. Know all colonists by these present. We, the household, in order to safeguard domestic order, provide for the equal share, promote the protection of the sanctuary, establish fairness in all matters of work and trade, and provide for the common defense of the colony, its material assets, and all souls who dwell within its walls, until the day of return, do ordain and establish this document of one law. The household. The household shall be composed of the oldest member of each of the surviving first families. Patel, Jackson, Molyneux, Fisher, Chow, Curtis, Boys, Norris. Not to exclude those who have joined a second family by marriage, including Walker families, or in such cases as the oldest surviving member declines to serve, by another of his surname. The household shall act in consultation with the Board of the Trades to oversee all matters of defense, production, illumination, and distribution of equal shares, final authority to be retained by the household in all matters of dispute and in times of civil emergency. The household shall elect one of its members to be head of the household, that person alone to serve without encumbrance of a secondary trade. The Seven Trades. All duties of work within the colony and without its walls, including the power station and turbines and grazing fields and pits, shall be divided into the seven trades, to include the watch, heavy duty, light and power, agriculture, livestock, commerce and manufacturing, and sanctuary infirmary. Each of the seven trades, works, shall be self-administering, the heads of trade to form the Board of Trades, reporting to the household in such manner as the household determines and at its sole discretion. The watch. The watch is henceforth known to be one of the seven trades, equal to all others, and comprised of no fewer than one first captain, 3 second captains, 15 full watch, and a number of runners to be determined. All firearms and piercing weapons, longbows, crossbows, blades longer than 10 centimeters, within the walls of the colony are to be kept and stored in the armory under the protection of the watch. The sanctuary. Each child shall remain in the safety of the sanctuary, F.D. Roosevelt Elementary School, never to leave its walls until the age of 8 years, to depart its confines on the advent of her 8th birthday, whereupon that child shall select a trade, subject to the needs of the colony and the approval of the household and the Board of Trades. That child's equal share shall, upon his release from the sanctuary, revert to the household of which he is a part, to be carried with him at the time of his marriage. Children in the sanctuary are to know nothing of the world in its present form outside the colony's walls, including any mention of the virals, the duties of the watch, and the event known as the Great Viral Cataclysm. Any person found to knowingly provide such information to any minor child is subject to the penalty of putting without the walls. Rights of Walkers. Walkers, or souls not of the first families, are fully endowed with equal shares, not to be deprived of such shares by any person, with the exception of unmarried males who choose to dwell within the barracks under the shares of their trades. Law of Quarantine. Any soul, whether first family or walker, who comes into direct physical contact with a viral must be quarantined for a period of no fewer than 30 days. Any soul, whether quarantined or at liberty, who exhibits symptoms of viral infection, including but not limited to seizures, vomiting, aversion to light, changes in eye coloration, blood hunger, or spontaneous disrobing, may be subject to immediate confinement and or merciful execution by the watch. Any soul who opens the gates, whether wholly or in part, by accident or design, alone or in the company of others, between second evening bell and first morning bell, is subject to the penalty of putting without the walls. Any soul who owns, operates, or encourages the operation of a radio or other signaling device is subject to the penalty of putting without the walls. Any soul who commits the crime of murdering another soul, such act to be defined as deliberately causing the physical death of another without sufficient provocation of infection, is subject to the penalty of putting without the walls. Thus enacted and ratified in the year of our waiting, 17 AV, Devon Danforth Chow, Federal Emergency Management Agency, Deputy Regional Administrator of the Central Quarantine Zone, Head of Household. Terrence Jackson, Lucy Fisher Jackson, Porter Curtis, Liam Molyneux, Sonia Patal Levine, Christian Boys, Will and Norris Darrell, First Families. Chapter 19. On a fading summer evening, late in the last hours of his old life, Peter Jackson, son of Demetrius and Prudence Jackson, First Family, descendant of Terence Jackson, signatory of the One Law, great-great-nephew of the one known as Auntie, last of the first, Peter of Souls, the man of days, and the one who stood, took his position on the catwalk above Main Gate, waiting to kill his brother. He was 21 years old, full watch, tall though he did not think of himself as tall, with a narrow, high-browed face and strong teeth and skin the color of late honey. He had his mother's eyes, green with flecks of gold. His hair, which was Jackson hair, coarse and dark, was pulled away from his brow in the style of the watch, compressed into a tight, nut-like knob at the base of his skull with a single leather loop. A web of shallow creases fanned from the corners of his eyes, squinting into the yellowing light. There was, at the margin of his left temple, a single, hard-won streak of gray. He wore a pair of scavenged gaps, motley patched at the knees and seat, and cinched at his slender waist a jersey of soft wool, beneath which he could feel the day's scrim of dirty perspiration prickling his skin. He had taken the gaps from the storehouse 3 seasons ago, at share. They had cost him an eighth. He had bargained Walt Fisher down from a quarter, a ridiculous price for a pair of gaps. But that's how Walt did things. The price was never the price. And were too long in the legs by a hand, gathering in bunches at the tops of his feet, shod in sandals of cut canvas and old tire. He always wore sandals in the heat of the year, or else went barefoot, reserving his one pair of decent boots for winter. Resting at an angle against the edge of the rampart was his weapon, a crossbow. At his waist, in its sheath of soft leather, a blade. Peter Jackson, 21, armed at full watch. Standing the wall as his brother had done, and his father before him. Standing to serve the mercy. It was the 63rd of summer. The day is still long and dry under wide blue skies, the air fresh with the scents of juniper and jeffrey pine. The sun stood 2 hands. First evening bell had sounded from the sanctuary, summoning the night shift to the wall and calling in the herd from upper field. The platform on which he stood, 1 of 15 distributed along the catwalk that ringed the top of the wall, was known as Firing Platform 1. Usually it was reserved to the first captain of the watch, Sue Ramirez, but not tonight. Tonight, as for each of the last 6 nights, it was Peter's alone. 5 meters square, it was edged by an overhanging net of cabled steel. To Peter's left, rising another 30 meters, stood one of the 12 light assemblies, rows of sodium vapor bulbs in a grid, dim now in the last of day. To his right, suspended over the nets, was the crane with its block and tackle and ropes. This Peter would use to lower himself to the base of the wall, should his brother return. Behind him, forming a comforting cloud of noise and smells and activity, lay the colony itself, its houses and stables and fields and greenhouses and glens. This was the place where Peter had lived his whole life. Even now, facing away to watch the herd come home, he could hold each meter of it in his mind, a mental inventory in 3 dimensions with complete sensory accompaniment. the long path from the gate to Old Town, past the armory with its music of hammering metal and the shaded recesses of West Glade where Auntie lived. The fields with their rows of corn and beans, the backs of the workers bent low over the black earth, tilling and hoeing. The broad semicircular plaza known as the Sunspot, where the trading days and open meetings of the household were held. The sanctuary, with its ringing bell tower and bricked-in windows and coils of concertina wire, barricades that somehow failed to suppress the voices of the littles playing in the courtyard. The pens and barns and grazing fields and coops, alive with the sound and smell of animals. The three greenhouses, their interiors obscured by a fog of humidity, and standing adjacent, the vast scavenged bounty of the storehouse, where Walter Fisher presided over the stalls of clothes and tools and food and fuel. The blocks of houses in various states of repair, from crumbling cabins long abandoned to those that, like Peter's, had been continuously occupied since the day. The orchard and buzzing apiary and old trailer park where nobody lived anymore, and beyond it, past the last houses of the north quarter and the big shed, at the base of the cutout between the north and east walls in a zone of perpetual cooling shade, the battery stack, three gray bulks of humming metal wrapped by wire and pipe, still resting on the sunken wheels of the semi-trailers that had pulled them up the mountain in the time before. The herd had crested the rise. Peter watched from above as they approached, a jostling, bleeding mass that flowed like liquid up the hill, followed by the riders, six in all, tall on their mounts. The herd moved as one toward him through the gap in the fire line, their hooves kicking up a cloud of dust. As the riders passed under his post, each gave Peter a tight nod of acknowledgement, as they had for each of the last six evenings. No words would pass between them. It was bad luck, Peter knew, to speak to someone waiting on the Mercy. One of the riders broke away. Sarah Fisher. Sarah was a nurse by trade. Peter's own mother had been the one to train her. But like many people, she had more than one job. And Sarah was built to ride. Slender but strong, with an alert physical presence in the saddle and a quick, supple style on the reins. She was dressed, as all the riders were, in a loose jersey cinched at the waist, above leggings of patched denim. Her hair, a sun-warmed blonde cut short to the shoulders, was tied away, a single loose strand swaying over her eyes, deep-set and dark. A leather bow guard sheathed her left arm from elbow to wrist. The bow itself, a meter long, was slung diagonally across her back like a single jouncing wing. Her horse, a 15-year-old gelding known as Dash, was said to prefer her above all others, pinning his ears and flicking his tail at anyone else who attempted to ride him. But not Sarah. Under Sarah's command, he moved with a responsive grace, horse and rider seeming to share each other's thoughts, becoming one. As Peter watched, she cut through the gate again, against the current, back onto open ground. He saw what had drawn her away. A single lamb, a cosset born in spring, had wandered off, diverted by a patch of summer grass just inside the fire line. Setting her horse square to the tiny animal, Sarah swung to the ground and, in a burst of dexterous motion, rolled the lamb onto its back, roping its legs three times around. The last of the herd was passing through the gate now, a roiling wave of horses and sheep and riders heading down the trace that followed the curve of the west wall toward the pens. Sarah straightened and lifted her face toward the place where Peter stood on the catwalk. Their eyes met quickly across the gap. On any other occasion, he thought she would have smiled. As Peter looked on, she hoisted the lamb to her chest and draped it across the horse's back, holding it in place with a steadying hand while she swung up into the saddle. A second meeting of the eyes, long enough to hold a sentence. "I hope Theo doesn't come either." Then before Peter could consider this further, Sarah flicked her heels and rode briskly through the gate, leaving him alone. Why did they do it? Peter wondered, as he had wondered through all the nights he'd stood. Why did they come home, the ones who'd been taken up? What force drove the mysterious impulse to return? a last melancholy memory of the person they'd once been? Did they come home to say goodbye? A viral, it was said, was a being without a soul. When Peter had turned 8 and been released from the sanctuary, it was Teacher, whose job this was, who had explained all of this to him. In its blood was a tiny creature called a virus that stole the soul away. The virus entered through a bite, typically to the neck, but not always, and once it was inside a person, the soul was gone, leaving the body behind to walk the earth forever. The person they had been was no more. These were the facts of the world, the one truth from which all other truths descended. Peter might just as well have been wondering what made the rain fall. And yet, standing on the catwalk in the sharpening dusk, the seventh and final night of the mercy, after which his brother would be declared dead, his name etched into the stone, his belongings carted off to the storehouse to be patched and repaired and redistributed at share, he thought it. Why would a viral come home if it had no soul? The sun stood just one hand above the horizon now, descending quickly into the wavy line where the foothills declined to the valley floor. Even in high summer the days seemed to end this way, in a kind of plunge. Peter cupped his eyes against the glare. Somewhere out there, past the fire line with its loose jumble of felled timber, and the grazing grounds of Upper Field, and the dump with its pit and piles, and the scrubby woodlands hills beyond, lay the ruins of Los Angeles, and farther still, the unimaginable sea. When Peter was a little and still living in the sanctuary, he had learned about this in the library. Although it had been decided long ago that most of the books the builders had left behind were of no value, and potentially confusing to the littles who were not to know anything about the virals or what had happened to the world of the time before, a few were allowed to remain. Sometimes Teacher would read to them stories about children and fairies and talking animals who lived in a forest behind the doors of a closet, or else allow them to select a book on their own to look at the pictures and read as best they could. The Oceans Around Us. That had been Peter's favorite, the book he'd always chosen. A faded volume, its pages dank-smelling and cool to the touch, the cracked binding held together by bits of curling yellow tape. On the cover was the name of the author, Ed Time Life, and inside, page after wondrous page of pictures and photos and maps. One map was called The World, which was everything, and most of the world was water. Peter asked Teacher to help him read the names. Atlantic, Pacific, Indian, Arctic. Hour after hour he sat on his mat in the big room, the book cradled in his lap, turning the pages, his eyes locked onto these blue spaces on the maps. The world, he gathered, was round, a great watery ball, a dewdrop hurtling through the sky, and all the water was connected. The rains of spring and snows of winter, the water that poured from the pumps, even the clouds above their heads. That was all part of the oceans, too. Where was the ocean? Peter asked Teacher one day. Could he see it? But Teacher only laughed, as she always did when he asked too many questions, dismissing his concerns with a shake of her head. Maybe there's an ocean, and maybe there isn't. It's only a book, little Peter. Don't you go worrying about oceans and such. But Peter's father had seen the ocean. His father, the great Demetrius Jackson, head of the household, and Peter's uncle Willem, first captain of the watch. Together they'd led the long rides farther than anyone had ever gone since before the day. Eastward, toward the morning sun, and west to the horizon line, and farther still into the empty cities of the time before. Always his father returned with stories of the great and terrible sights he'd seen, but none was more wondrous than the ocean, in a place he called the Long Beach. Imagine, Peter's father told the two of them, for Theo was there as well, the two Jackson brothers sitting at the kitchen table of their small house in the hour of their father's return, raptly listening, drinking his words like water. Imagine a place where the ground simply stopped, and beyond that place an endless, tumbling blueness, like the sky turned upside down. And sunk down in it, the rusting ribs of great ships, 1,000,000 of them, like a whole drowned city of man's creation, jutting from the ocean's waters as far as the eye could see. Their father was not a man of words. He communicated only with the most sparing phrases and parceled his affections the same way, letting a hand on a shoulder or a well-timed frown or, in moments of approval, a terse nod from the chin do most of his speaking for him. But the stories of the long rides brought out the voice in him. Standing on the ocean's edge, his father said, you could feel the bigness of the world itself, how quiet and empty it was. How alone, with no man or woman to look at it or say its name through all the years and years. Peter was 14 when his father returned from the sea. Like all the Jackson males, including his older brother Theo, Peter had apprenticed to the watch, hoping some day to join his father and uncle on the long rides. But this never happened. The following summer, the scouting party was ambushed in a place his father called Milagro, deep in the eastern deserts. 3 souls lost, including Uncle Willem, and there were no more long rides after that. People said that it was his father's fault, that he had gone too far, taken too many chances, and for what? None of the other colonies had been heard from in years. The last, Taos colony, had fallen almost 80 years ago. Their final transmission, back before the separation of the trades and the one law, when radio was still permitted, said their power plant was failing, the lights were going out. Surely they'd been overrun like all the others. What was Demo Jackson hoping to accomplish, leaving the safety of the lights for months at a time? What did he hope to find out there in the dark? There were those who still spoke of the day of return, when the army would come back to find them, but never in all his travels had Demo Jackson found the army. The army was no more. So many men dead now, to learn what they already knew. And it was true that from the day Peter's father returned from the last long ride, there was something different about him. A great weary sadness, as if he'd leapt abruptly forward in age. It was as if a part of him had been left in the desert with Willem, whom Peter knew his father loved most of all, more than Peter or Theo or even their mother. His father stepped down from the household, passing his seat to Theo. He began to ride alone, leaving with the herds at first light, returning just minutes before second evening bell. He never told anyone where he went, as far as Peter knew. When he asked his mother, all she could say was that his father was in his own time now. When he was ready, he would return to them. The morning of his father's final ride, Peter, a runner of the watch by this time, was standing on the catwalk near Main Gate when he saw his father preparing to leave. The lights had just gone down. Morning bell was about to sound. It had been a quiet night, without sign, and for an hour before dawn, a light snow had fallen. The day broke slowly, gray and cold. As the herd was gathering at the gate, Peter's father appeared on his mount, the great roan mare he always rode, headed down the trace. The horse was called Diamond because of the marking on her brow, an orphaned splash of white beneath the swishing mask of her long forelock. Not an especially fast mount, his father always said, but loyal and tireless, and quick when you needed her to be quick. Now, watching his father holding her reins, standing at the rear of the herd while he waited for the gate to open, Peter saw Diamond do a little quick step, tamping down the snow. Jets of steam puffed from her nostrils, swirling like a wreath of smoke around her long, self-possessing face. His father bent low and stroked the side of her neck. Peter saw his lips moving as he whispered something, some gentle encouragement into her ear. When Peter thought of that morning, 5 years ago, he still wondered if his father had known he was there, observing him from the snow-slickened catwalk. But he had never lifted his eyes to find him, nor had Peter done anything to alert his father to his presence. Watching him as he spoke to Diamond, stroking the side of her neck with his calming hand, Peter had thought of his mother's words, and knew them to be true. His father was in his own time now. Always, in the last moments before morning bell, Demo Jackson would retrieve his compass from his waist pouch and open it once to examine it, then snap it closed as he called his head count to the watch. "One out," he would call in his deep, barrel-chested voice. "One back," the gatekeeper would reply. Always the same ritual, meticulously observed. But not that morning. It was only after the gates had opened and his father had passed, taking Diamond down the power station road away from the grazing fields, that Peter realized his father had carried no bow, that the sheath at his belt was empty. That night, second bell rang without him. As Peter would soon learn, his father had taken water at the power station midday and was last seen heading out under the turbines into open desert. It was generally held that a mother could not stand for one of her own children, nor a wife for a husband. Though nothing was written, the job of the Mercy had naturally fallen to a chain of fathers and brothers and eldest sons performing this duty since the day. So it was that Theo had stood for their father, as Peter now stood for Theo, just as someone, perhaps a son of his own, would stand for Peter should that day come. Because if the person wasn't dead, if they'd been taken up, they always came home. It might be 3 days or five or even a week, but never longer than that. Most were watchers, taken on scavenging parties or trips to the power station, or else riders with the herd or the heavy-duty crews who went outside to log or do repairs or drag garbage to the dump. Even in broad daylight, people were killed or taken. You were never really safe as long as the virals had shade to move in. The youngest homecomer that Peter knew of had been the little boy's girl. Sharon? Sherry? 9 years old when she was taken up on dark night. The rest of her family had been killed outright, either in the quake itself or the attack that followed. With no one left to stand for her, it had been Peter's Uncle Willem, as first captain, who had done this awful job. Many, like the boy's girl, were fully taken up by the time they returned. Others appeared in the midst of their quickening, sick and shuddering, tearing the clothing from their bodies as they staggered into view. The ones furthest along were the most dangerous. More than one father or son or uncle had been killed in this manner. But generally they offered no resistance. Most just stood there at the gate, blinking into the spotlights, waiting for the shot. Peter supposed that some part of them still remembered being human well enough to want to die. His father never returned, which meant he was dead, killed by the virals out in the Darklands, at a place called Milagro. Their father had claimed he'd seen a walker there, a solitary figure darting in the moonlit shadows just before the virals attacked. But by that time, with the household and even old Chow having turned against the long rides, and Peter's father in disgrace, having resigned to pursue his mysterious solitary expeditions without the wall, moving in the expanding orbit that even then had seemed to Peter a rehearsal for something final, no one had believed him. A claim as bold as that. Surely it was just Demo Jackson's desire to continue the rides that made him claim something so absurd. The last walker to come in had been the Colonel almost 30 years ago, and he was an old man now. With his great white beard and wind-bit face, brown and thickened as tanned hide, he seemed nearly as old as old Chow, or even Auntie herself, last of the first. A single walker after all these years? Impossible. Even Peter hadn't known what to believe. Until 6 days ago. Now, standing on the catwalk in the fading light, Peter found himself wishing his mother were still alive, as he often did, to talk about these things. She'd taken sick just a season after their father's final ride, the onset of her illness so gradual that Peter had at first failed to notice the raspy cough from deep in her chest, how thin she was becoming. As a nurse, she had probably understood only too well what was happening, how the cancer that took so many had made its lethal home inside her, but had chosen to hide this information from Peter and Theo as long as she could. By the end, not much was left of her but a shell of flesh on bone, fighting for a single taste of breath. A good death, everyone agreed, to die at home, in bed, as Prudence Jackson had. But Peter had been at her side through the final hours, and knew how terrible it had been for her, how much she'd suffered. No, there was no such thing as a good death. The sun was folding into the horizon now, laying the last of its golden road across the valley below. The sky had turned a deep blue-black, drinking up the darkness that was spilling from the east. Peter felt the temperature drop, a quick, decisive notch of cooling. For a moment everything seemed held in a thrumming stillness. The men and women of the night shift were ascending the ladders now. Ian Patal and Ben Chow and Galen Strauss and Sonny Greenberg and all the rest, 15 in sum, crosses and longbows slung over their backs, calling out to one another as they thumped and clanged down the catwalks to the firing posts, Alicia barking orders from below, sending the runners scurrying. A small comfort, but real enough, the sound of Alicia's voice. It was she who had stood by Peter through all the nights of waiting, leaving him be but never venturing far so that he'd know she was there. And should Theo return, it would be Alicia who would ride down the wall with Peter to do what needed to be done. Peter drew in a deep breath of evening air and held it. The stars, he knew, would soon be out. Auntie had spoken often of the stars, as his father had, spread out over the sky like glowing grains of sand, more stars than all the souls who had ever lived, their numbers impossible to count. Whenever his father had spoken of them, telling the stories of the long rides and the sights he'd seen, the light of the stars had been in his eyes. But Peter was not to see the stars tonight. The bell commenced to ring again, 2 hard peals, and Peter heard Sue Ramirez calling from below, "Clear the gate! Clear the gate for second bell!" A deep, bone-shaking shudder below him as the weights engaged. With a shriek of metal, the doors, 20 meters tall and 0.5 meter thick, began to slide from their walled pockets. As he lifted his cross from the platform, Peter made a silent wish that morning would find it unfired. And then the lights came on. Chapter 20 Log of the Watch, Summer 92. Day 41, no sign. Day 42, no sign. Day 43, 2306. Single viral sighted at 200 meters, firing post 3, no approach. Day 44, no sign. Day 45, 0200, pod of 3 at firing post 6. One target breaks off and attempts the wall. Arrows released from firing post 5 and 6. Target retreats. No further contact. Day 46, no sign. Day 47, 0115. Runner Kit Darrell reports movement at fireline northwest between firing post 9 and firing post 10, unconfirmed by watch on station, officially logged as no sign. Day 48, 2140, pod of 3 at firing post 1, 200 meters. One target makes approach to 100 meters but retreats without engagement. Day 49, no sign. Day 50, 2215, pod of 6 at firing post 7. Hunting small game, no approach. 2305, pod of three at firing post three. Two males, one female. Full engagement, one KO. Kill at the nets made by Arlo Wilson. Assist to Alicia Donadio, second captain. Body disposal referred to HD. Note to HD crew to repair split seam toehold at firing post six. Received by Finn Darrell for HD. During this period, six contacts, one unconfirmed, one KO. No souls killed or taken. Respectfully submitted to the household, S.C. Ramirez, first captain. To the extent that any singular occurrence may be meaningfully placed within a local framework of events, the disappearance of Theo Jackson, first family and household, a second captain of the watch, could be said to have been set in motion 12 days prior, on the morning of the 51st of summer, after a night in which a viral had been killed in the nets by the watcher Arlo Wilson. The attack had come in the early evening from the south, near firing platform 3. Peter, stationed at his post on the opposite side of the colony's perimeter, had seen nothing. It wasn't until the early morning hours, as the resupply detail was assembling at the gate, that he received a full recounting. The attack was in most ways typical, of the kind that occurred nearly every season, though most often in summer. A pod of three, two males and one large female. It was thought by Sue Ramirez, and others were in agreement, that this was probably the same pod that had been sighted twice over the previous 5 nights, prowling near the fireline. It often happened this way, in discrete stages, spread over several nights. A group of virals would appear at the edge of the lights, as if scouting the colony's defenses. This would be followed by a couple of nights of no sign. Then they would appear again, closer this time, perhaps one breaking away to draw fire, but always retreating. Then, on a third night, an attack. The wall was far too high for even the strongest viral to mount it in a single leap. The only way for them to ascend was along the metal seams between the plates, employing these slender cracks caused by the inevitable shifting of the plates as toeholds. The firing platforms, with their overhanging steel nets, were positioned at the tops of these seams. Any viral who made it this far was usually fogged by the lights, sluggish and disoriented. Many simply retreated at this point. Those that didn't would find themselves hanging in an inverted position under the nets, giving the watcher on station ample opportunity to shoot them in the sweet spot with a crossbow, or failing this, to take them on a blade. Only rarely did a viral make it past the net. Peter had seen this occur only once during his 5 years on the wall, but when one did, it invariably meant the watcher was dead. After that, it was simply a question of how weakened the viral was by the lights, and how long it took the watch to bring him down, and how many people.